Game On on 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green for getting us through the day. It's Thursday, the 15th of July, and this is Game On. Coming up today, sand wedges at Sandwich. We get the latest from the Open as golf's oldest major is well underway.
I say I played pretty average. I didn't play my best golf. Disappointed to bogey the last. I think if I had a par the last and shot level par, I would have been quite happy with myself, you know, going home this afternoon. But, you know, I didn't. I got an unfortunate bounce and went into the bunker and made bogey, but you know, I battled hard. I was quite proud of myself, and on to tomorrow.
As captain Alan Wynne-Jones returns to the matchday squad, Stephen Ferris looks at where it went wrong for the Lions in their Springboks defeat last night.
They're in the change rooms saying there's no reason why we can't win the series. You know, and credit to South Africa, they were very physical and very aggressive at the breakdown at the start of that game, and we worked our way back into it. So, you know, lots of positives and lots of things for us to work on. We needed that game, and it will be a lot better for that.
Paul Corrie is in studio with updates on a big night for the Irish clubs in the Europa Conference League. And nutritionist Orla Walsh will tell us how Olympians fuel their way to glory.
Hi, I'm Olympic champion Michael Phelps. You know, I had to sacrifice a lot to earn 8 gold medals at the Beijing Olympics. But one thing I never sacrificed was a good meal.
Tired of suffering through a salad at lunch?
Then cozy up to a pound of pasta, 3 Cuban sandwiches smothered in mayonnaise, a fried turkey stuffed with molasses, a barrel of Halloween candy, and to wash it all down, a pitcher of hollandaise sauce.
Now, if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, as I mentioned, Paul Corrie is with me in the studio. He is going to be watching the League of Ireland games tonight. First up will be Sligo Rovers. They are 1-0 down to FH. They kicked off just at 6 p.m. So Paul will have updates for us, and he'll also be watching when he gets home. He'll be watching Bowes, who are playing Stirnam, and it is level at 1-1 from their first leg. How are you, Paul?
Yeah, really good, Murray.
It's a day for watching sport, actually. It's day one of action at the Open in Royal St. George, and Greg Allen is there for us. Greg?
Yeah, well, Marie, it's been a day when the conditions have been pretty much perfect. We started with bright sunshine. The bright sunshine had a bit of breeze attached to it. That was at 6:35 this morning when Richard Bland teed off, and what a man to tee off, the 48-year-old who led the US Open, jointly led the US Open at the halfway point and also won the British Masters, the oldest first-time winner on the European Tour, rewarded with the opportunity of hitting the first shot at the Open. And in doing so, he went round in a very nice, tidy round of 70, level par. But that was an indicator that there was good scoring to be had. And the scoring, as the day got better, the wind began to drop, saw lots and lots of birdies being made. It's a very tight par of 70 around Royal St. George's. It's not a particularly long course. So the top of the leaderboard sees Louis Oosthuizen, who's been runner-up in the last two majors and is absolutely showing the form which we thought he would have shown after winning the Open back in 2010 by 7 shots. He hasn't won a major since then, but he has been runner-up 5 times since then. And Oosthuizen on 6 under par after a round of 64 is the leader here, from Jordan Spieth, who shot a 65. Brian Harman, third in the Players' Championship last March, he shot a 65 as well. And Mackenzie Hughes, who was tied for the lead entering the US Open final round, the Canadian in form again, around a 67. And the group on 4 under par also includes Dylan Fratelli of South Africa, Stuart Sink, who is a 48-year-old former winner of the Open back in 2009. He shot 67 for 4 under par. And Benjamin Hébert of France, also 4 under par. So there's lots and lots of players under par figures. I'm just scrolling down now and counting 45 so far. And none of them are Irish. And well, the reason for that is because, well, none of them have played particularly well. Darren Clark was out at 8:25 this morning. He shot around a 71, nearly 53 years of age. Shane Lowry, obviously the defending champion, looked a bit nervous on the first tee. Big deep breath he took before he snapped his drive into heavy rough off the first, took bogey in the next hole. But from there on, he actually played very solidly, covered the last 16 holes in 1 under. Sad that he made a bogey on the last, because he'd made birdies in 16 and 17. But Lowry signed for a 71. Now, tied for 71st place is not the type of start you want if you're going to try and win an Open Championship. But he is at the moment 7 off the lead, and that's not an insurmountable gap to make up over 3 rounds. But it does look like he needs to shoot something in the 60s tomorrow. Certainly mid to high 60s. around 65, 66 would be lovely. But certainly at the moment, if he feels that he needs to get into contention, I think Shane Lowry needs something of that order at 65 tomorrow. John Rahm also had struggles, had a double bogey on his card. He's the pre-tournament favourite, and he was playing with Lowry. He shot 71 as well, but he finished with a birdie on 18 to give himself a bit of momentum. Currently on the course, Rory McIlroy started so well. He hit a wedge from 102 yards to just 3 feet from the hole in the first for a birdie three. And if you might remember back in 2019, he opened with a quadruple bogey eight at Royal Portrush, so 5 strokes better in his first hole today. But unfortunately, he bogeyed 5, 6 and 7. Now, he has fought back with a birdie in the 8th and he's 1 over after 10. And like McIlroy, or like Lowry, should say, Rory McIlroy needs to find birdies to feel he can get into contention here, because the scoring has been hot all round. Paddy Carrington, he's shot a round of 2 over par 72, started with a double bogey, also bogeyed the 18th. And Harrington back in a tie for 94th place, even with a round of 72, which doesn't sound that bad, but scoring has been particularly good today. And these winds from the northeast are light enough today. They're not supposed to get up to any great speed over the next 3 days. And I think it's going to be a very, very, very hot scoring weekend. It has to be said, though, that Louis Oosthuizen, with the way he's played in the last two majors and the way he started here, two runners up and a 64 today, you got to think that he's the man at the moment, because he has won the Open before in 2010, as I said. But the main man chasing him, Jordan Spieth, the champion in 2017, is seriously one to watch. The world number one, incidentally, Dustin Johnson, who had a great chance of winning back in 2011 when Darren Clark won. Johnson went out of bounds on 14 at a critical point in the final round. Johnson hasn't had great form, has only had one top 10 in the last 4 months, but Johnson opened with a round of 2 under par 68. So that's a solid start. But for the Irish, all of them over par figures here. Lowry 1 over, Harrington 2 over, Clark 1 over par, and Rory McIlroy currently at 1 over par.
Okay, Greg, and Justin, from looking and seeing as much as you did today, who for you, besides the leaders, anybody showing form maybe that you weren't expecting?
Well, the thing about it is, it's the first round of a major golf championship with a lot of people shooting good scores. So no, I just think that Jordan Spieth starting with a 65, and the fact that, you know, the quiet man of golf, Louis Oosthuizen, I mean, he's had this extraordinary record of runner-up finishes in all of the majors, as well as winning the Open, and yet, you know, he gets so little credit for how good a player he is. But he is statistically the best putter on the PGA Tour for most of this season. And when he starts with a 64, having finished runner-up in the last two majors, you can't ignore his credentials.
And what is it about him, Greg, what doesn't he have to propel him over the line?
Well, I'll tell you what he does have first. I'll be very positive. He has one of the most beautiful rhythmic swings in golf. In many ways, even better to watch than somebody like Rory McIlroy, because Rory McIlroy's swing is a thing of beauty, but it's got a lot of almost violent power in it. Louis hardly looks like he hits the ball with anything other than rhythm, and it still gets out there, you know, not that far behind Rory McIlroy. He's just a beautiful player. And the one thing about Louis in the years that have gone through since that 7-stroke win at St Andrews in 2010, which was really a very boring Open because he just dominated so much, he has never been the best of putters, and he is one of the best putters in the world right now, maybe statistically the best putter in the world right now. And so rather than dwell on what hasn't gone well for him, there is this sense that Louis doesn't always produce the aggressive play when he needs to, when he needs to push forward in the final round. And we saw that at the US Open in Torrey Pines when, you know, he put his drive on the 17th into the water hazard on the left-hand side. It cost him a bogey. He missed a putt from about 9 feet there to save par. It was just the type of thing you don't do when you're in position to win. Now, admittedly, John Rahm holed 2 15-foot putts or thereabouts in the final two greens to do exactly what Louis didn't do, something really forward momentum generating. Louis on the 18th had a chance of reaching the green and decided to lay up. It was a par five. Now, he would have had to hole his shot, and that really was an impossible task virtually. But at least it was a shot to nothing, and it would have been a chance of possibly, you know, admittedly from 100 or 200 yards, wasn't likely. But he chose to lay up, which gave him no chance of winning. So you might just question to some degree, does he produce the shots when he needs to? It's one thing producing them in the first, second and third rounds, but in the final round, does he do it? Not in the last two majors.
Okay, well, he said after that round that it was the perfect one that he could have played. So hopefully there will be plenty more of them. Greg, thank you so much. We'll check in with you a little bit later. We're going to take a quick break now. Well, we're not going to take a quick break now, Paul, but we're going to have a chat about the football. So it's probably close enough to 15 minutes in. How's it going so far, Sligo Rovers, in European action tonight?
Yeah, similar to last week. Listen, they're one down from the first leg, but they've started the
game. I'm going to stop you, Paul, because we're going to take our break.
How much your heart races watching your team. Thanks to Betway. Game on 2FM.
Hello, welcome back. I was just about to ask Paul Carey how Sligo Rovers were getting on in European action tonight against FH. Paul, probably close to 15 minutes gone. How are they doing?
Yeah, Sligo started really well, Marie. And in typical Liam Buckley fashion, they make the pitch big, they move the ball around, they try to shift the opposition, and they've gotten in behind FH on two occasions. Romeo Parks at one half, decent chance, and then Jordan Gibson getting in behind and the ball ricocheted around the box. It does have the feeling the teams are very evenly matched. The first goal is going to be huge, and if Sligo were to go 2-0 down, you would worry that the gap is going to be too big to recover. But they're very much in this game. It's great to see fans in the showgrounds, and they're more than in this match. And if they can create enough chances and they get themselves on the score sheet, it's great to see Kenny back in the team. They've more than got a chance of going through in this round.
Yeah, just interestingly, because the last time when they went away, they were a depleted side, I think it's fair to say. And you mentioned Johnny Kenny there was somebody who wasn't available, but he is back, and he has that ability to change a game, to do something special.
Yeah, he's raw. He really is raw. And you like that when you've got a centre forward. He's going to run people in behind. He can take them to feed. And he tends to link up quite well with Romeo Parks. And listen, he's bagged a hat-trick earlier on this season. He's got goals to his name. So that's always good when you've got your strikers in form. And that's something that they're going to need tonight. You did mention that they're down a number of players. And that is maybe one area that you would look at maybe hindering them advancing this evening. They've got Greg Bulger, suspended from last week, John Mahon at the back, and McGinty. And when I always look at teams, I look at that core spine, and to miss three of them, from your keeper to your back four and into your midfield, they're three big players for that squad. So it's an uphill challenge. They've definitely got the players, and Liam Buckley has the style of play to advance here, and there's definitely not a lot between the teams, so it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, and we know that Sligo can be a difficult place to go, especially when there's a few fans there, so hopefully they will get the job done tonight. Bows are also in action tonight as well. They're playing Stirling, aggregate score 1-1 in the Aviva Stadium, kickoff 7:45, and there are going to be 6,000 fans there. You couldn't ask for any more given the current situation.
No, it's huge. It's a huge occasion for Bows in general. You know, the momentous, I guess, growth that they've had in the last number of years within the community, but also on the pitch and the playing staff and also the coaching staff. They're making strides and they're heading in the right direction. I personally feel like they actually went very close last year to progressing in Europe. I actually feel they've got a better squad this year that's more suited to European football. When we talk about Irish clubs playing in Europe, we're always talking about how well can we retain possession, how well can we keep the ball, because there's long periods when the opposition have it that you're actually draining energy. I think with the likes of your Tierneys, your Devoys, your Georgie Kellys, you've definitely got players there who can retain it. And it's a big occasion. I hope it doesn't get to them. I hope it doesn't hinder them, because playing in the Aviva is a massive change from Daily Mint. It's not something that they're used to. But to have 6,000 fans who are so pivotal to that club roaring them on, they showed last week that they're more within the tie. They've definitely got the players to go on and win it. Fingers crossed, because it's really important for our league, for our coefficient, for finances, that our teams progress.
It's a big pitch though, isn't it? I mean, can you get used to playing in a pitch that big in a short period of time?
It's funny, Marie, because a lot of the pitches are relatively similar in size, but you go to different stadiums and certain stadiums just feel bigger, and the Aviva sometimes has that feel as well, that if you're chasing the ball, you're really draining energy, and it's hard to eat up that ground if you're a midfielder or you're a fullback to cover the ground. It's different, and you wonder, by going to the Aviva, are they sacrificing a bit of home advantage? That would be a small bit of a worry for me. But like I mentioned, they've got players who retain the ball quite well, that it could work in their favour. It's just, is it a bit of a lottery going to the Aviva for the first time for pretty much all of that squad? Are you sacrificing a bit of home advantage in Europe? You would like to hope not, but it does have a bit of a
strange feel. Yeah, it is a bit
a
of a risk.
Feel.
I guess I didn't think about that really, because I was just buying into the occasion and the fans and, you know, what you'd want from a special European night. And just, look, they're, you know, you think they're going to come around all the time, and they actually don't, you know. So when they do, you do need to make the most of them.
My gut feeling would tell me that Shamrock Rovers were probably offered that for the Champions League tie, and I get a feeling, and I've heard a few rumours, that they turned it down because they wanted to play in Tala.
Yeah, and it nearly paid off. And we were talking about it the other night, and you weren't very confident, but they nearly got there.
nearly, but not quite.
And just like in terms of Keith Long and the job that he has done, and, you know, this is obviously a little bit different. He's been approaching his league games a certain way and going well. And you mentioned Georgie Kelly and what a success story he's been. But how is he going to approach this one?
Yeah, I don't think he'll approach it too much differently than any of the league games. I like the players I mentioned, the likes of your Kurtz, your Ali Coutts. These players that have come in have really stepped up to the mark, because last year a lot of us were talking about Danny Grant and Chris Twardeck and them being the kind of the attacking impetus for their team. The fact that they've lost them, they've had to reinvent themselves again, and they were probably a bit more direct last year. They're more of a ball playing team this year, and that probably suits them in Europe. And I would imagine that Keith Long is going to tell them nothing different to any league game that they have, that they want to keep the ball, they want to manipulate the ball, they want to create chances, and they certainly have the players to do that. I guess with Europe and it being a two-legged tie, you just want to ensure that you don't make any silly mistakes, you don't want to take too many risks around your own box. But they're well within a chance, and they showed within the first leg that they're well within the tie, and they should, I feel anyway, go through tonight.
Okay, well, I have to say, you can say that it's like any other league game, but as you pointed out, then you walk into the Aviva Stadium and the vastness of it, and it certainly won't feel like it. Well, we are going to turn our attention now to rugby, because we were really excited about the Lions game last night and how close it was going to be, and it definitely felt like a real test last night, Stephen Ferris, didn't it?
It certainly did. A brilliant game of rugby. We were talking about the South Africa A team. I think there'll be maybe 10 or maybe even a dozen of those lads that started last night taking part in the first test match on the 24th of July, which is Saturday week. So very exciting, and it sort of feels, Marie, that the tour is now up and running. There's been so much chat around COVID about a few of the British and Irish Lions picking up COVID-19. Then it was in the South African camp. There was a match cancelled against the Bulls, and you know, a rearranged game against the Sharks, and it was all a bit of a mess, wasn't it? So finally things seem to be on the straight and narrow. Hopefully there's not too many more bumps in the road and we can get this test series completed. But yeah, it was a bit of a shock last night, especially the first 20 minutes. The South African A team come out all guns blazing and just set a real physical tone, and they probably deserved to be winners in the end up. I know the Lions come back into it in the second half, but they just didn't have enough to get over the line.
Yeah, you'd have to think that South Africa, just when you consider everything, will be quite happy with the game, just because they hadn't played rugby in such a long time, just one test against Georgia since winning the World Cup, and the fact that they had been locked in their hotel rooms as well for a week, and to be able to come out and to get to that intensity so quickly was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing, and I suppose being locked up, there's a lot of aggression and maybe a bit of anger being locked up in your hotel room for a period of time, but they just got out of the block so well, and the Lions couldn't deal with it at all. A couple of mistakes, Owen Farrell with the chip over the top that was blocked down by Etzebeth, and Damon Delande, all the Munster fans will know him very well. Mm-hmm. You know, a beautiful pick-up and pass to Nkosi, who scored in the corner, and even Louis Rees-Zama couldn't get over across in time to stop him. And you know, the first half was very there was lots of mistakes, a bit all over the place from the British and Irish Lions, and the South African lads held them out just on the stroke of half time as well, which mentally the Lions probably winning at half time a little bit down. But yeah, it's all teeing up very nicely, isn't it, for Saturday week?
It really is, and like, it has to be a positive for the Lions when you think about it as well, the fact that they were able to react to that change of standard and come out in the second half and raise their game.
Yeah, they did raise their game, Marie, but you know, you got to look at the South Africans as well. They tired massively. I think, you know, in the 50 minutes they were just happy enough to kick the leather off the ball, try and play field position, limit the amount of mistakes and penalties that they were making. They didn't play that much rugby at all. They had one offload in the game. We all know they're a very direct side, but they did look exhausted come the end of the match, and the Lions sort of looked like they were starting to find their groove. So, you know, I think if the Lions can throw the ball around a bit more, get on the edges, get a couple of more line breaks. They will score more points when it comes to the test matches. It's just getting around that up and in defence that the South Africans have. It's just so, so powerful. And it's not one-man tackles or two-man tackles. Usually it's three or four gang tackles, and they put you back on your backside. So, yeah, they're going to have their work cut out. But first of all, they've got a game this Saturday. It's against the Stormers in Cape Town. It's a 5 p.m. kickoff for anybody who's watching it. The Lions team, there's a few guys in there that you would expect to start in the first test. The likes of our own Tadhg Furlong here in Ireland, and Robbie Henshaw. It's brilliant to see him back after a few games of being absent because of a hamstring issue. So, yeah, there's a couple of guys representing Ireland there, but they need to get a win and get everything back on track before they hit the first test.
Yeah, it does feel like there's a lot of places still up for grabs. And you mentioned Robbie Henshaw there, who had been wrapped in cotton wool for a lot of the series, but he is back out now. And those centre positions do feel like they could still be anybody's. Bundyaki has started every game. He's not going to start at the weekend. Who do you think is going to take those jerseys?
Well, it's a good question. I've been doing a bit of media the last couple of days, and I was asking the question, I wonder if Brian O'Driscoll is still available, because he can move the slot in there, no issues. There's nobody that's really standing out. And, you know, one last opportunity this weekend before the first test. It's Robbie Henshaw and Elliot Daly playing 12 and 13. Elliot Daly's very versatile. He can play fullback. He can step into the wing as well. But yeah, I just think it's very much up for grabs. But if Robbie Henshaw has a fantastic game this weekend, I think he's nailed down to be a boulder for that test match next Saturday. In terms of the other positions, Marie, like, apart from Tadhg Furlong and Mara Toji, a tight head in second row, I think all the other positions are really up for grabs. You could maybe say Josh Adams in the wing, possibly Van der Merwe in the wing, but then, you know, I'm sure Reece Samet will have something to say about that, and also Anthony Watson. So every position is hotly contested. And, you know, some boys coming in and out of form. Conor Murray, as soon as he's picked up the captaincy, he sort of looked like he lost a little bit of form getting in there at the weekend. The other night against the A team. And Owen Farrell, like, we all thought he was going to kick on after his performance against the Sharks. He was brilliant, looked very good at 10. He wasn't supposed to start the game against South Africa, so maybe that's why his performance did dip a little in the first half. But, you know, just question marks over some of the players that you would nearly have a shoe-in only a couple of weeks ago.
How much trouble do you think Conor Murray is in after his performance last night? I didn't think it was all that bad, but he did get quite a lot of criticism in the press today.
Yeah, you know, like, you're always going to get the criticism when you're the captain and your team gets beaten. The Lions were not supposed to get beaten by South Africa A. I know there was lots of internationals and World Cup winners involved in that South African A team. Razzy Erasmus running about on the sidelines giving the messages, but they weren't supposed to get beaten. No, they were still big favourites for the match. And, you know, he's a leader, he's the captain, he's going to take the most of the brunt for that loss. I suppose there was a few issues as well just before halftime. Maybe they could have taken the scrum with a huge numerical advantage, 13 men against 15. Lay a seed of doubt into the South African scrum, and they just kept picking and going into that South African brick wall that just wouldn't give an inch. And then eventually, you know, just on halftime, I think it was Wynn Jones got done for a double movement, and there was a penalty, and that was the half. So just maybe around his decision making when it came to some of the captaincy calls, Marie, and as well a couple of box kicks, one in particular went out on the full, give possession straight back to South Africa, and just very small fine mistakes like that will cost you in these test matches that are just around the corner.
You mentioned the captaincy there, and Alan Wynne-Jones is named on the bench for this weekend's game. And you also mentioned the performance of Itoje there. The second row is quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is interesting. I honestly do not know how Alan Wynne-Jones is now in South Africa, about to come off the bench this weekend after a dislocated shoulder or sublux of a shoulder. It's just, it really is a bit of a miracle. But he's there. He's hardly played any rugby, Marie. Like, you think the Six Nations, then he only played a couple of games for the Ospreys, 7 minutes against Japan. He hasn't played another minute until making the bench this weekend. So, like, is he fit enough? Is he battle-hardened enough to you know, step into a test team next weekend alongside Mara Toji? I think Mara Toji has nailed down one of the spots for sure. Ian Henderson, everybody was talking about him, partnering Mara Toji, and then Hendy sort of, he didn't have a bad game, Marie, but it was sort of trying to pick holes in his performance just because he didn't stand out that much. And maybe that's the wrong thing to do. Maybe Warren Gatland won't do that either. But for me, he just didn't do enough. And then Adam Beer comes on in the second row substitute, and he has a brilliant, you know, 20 minutes off the bench and really lays down a marker to the other guys. So it's Adam Beard and Johnny Hill this weekend. He's starting the second row. Almond Jones is on the bench, ready to come on. So, yeah, I definitely think there's definitely one position, Marie, in the second row that's up for grabs to partner alongside Mario Toji.
In the back row then, Tyke Byrne, Jack Conan and Hamish Watson are combining there. Is there? Do you think that any of the Irish can get into it, just given the fact that Warren likes Folletau so much and Tom Curry has played so well?
Yeah, like I was really impressed with Tom Curry. I've been really impressed with Hamish Watson also on this tour. And, you know, Tyke Byrne's just been doing what Tyke Byrne does. He just goes about his work. He's actually scored a couple of tries and has looked half decent. Jack Conan, he's done what's been asked of him. I think Warren Gatland will still go with Folletau. There's the trust that's been there for the guts of a decade with Wales. He can rely on him. He knows he's a big game player. So, you know, Jack Conan's going to struggle to get into that match day 23 for me, because, you know, having a specialised number 8 on the bench maybe isn't the way to go. Where Tyke Byrne, I think, has got a hell of a better opportunity to make the test 23, just because he is a little bit more versatile. And Hamish Watson and Tom Curry, geez, flip a coin at the minute. I think Tom Curry's got the jersey, in my opinion. Although after Saturday, that opinion could change once again. But both terrific players, both very, very solid. Haven't been making any mistakes. A couple of turnovers. They carry the ball very well. Not huge men in stature, but they certainly punch above their weight. And you know, I'm super excited to see how they go over the next couple of weeks. But yeah, the back row is just always hotly contested. And I fancy Tom Curry to start at 7 in the test match next week, and for them to go with a line out, a really good line out option, like Tyke Byrne, like a Courtney Laws at number 6. We know how well that worked out in the tour in 2009 with Tom Croft coming into that position. So, I think we'll go with Toby Folletau at number 8. That's the way it is at the minute. It could be completely different next week, Marie.
It really could. Just from a player's point of view, because you've been there, obviously, what's it like, you know, as the test is nearing and, you know, the opportunities to prove yourself are diminishing, and anyone who's got credit in the bank is probably getting a little bit nervous if they're not getting a start in the final warm-up game?
Yeah, well, like, unfortunately for me, I picked up a knock just before the last warm-up game, which was against the Sharks in 2009. But I, even at that stage, I didn't have a feeling if I was close to the starting team for the test, or I was on the fringes, and there was no coaches that were pulling me aside saying, look, Stevie, you know, you're playing very well here at the minute, you know, keep the head down, you know, you're looking good for a test place, or you're looking good for the test squad or whatever. There was none of that. It was just full-blooded every day in training, very much getting stuck into one another, keeping the standards very, very high. And I'm sure it's very similar on the training pitch. Like, it's tough on the guys as well, just with not being able to go out, socialise and mix in the local communities, all because of COVID-19. So, you know, you got to make the most of the training days, and when it comes to the matches, get really stuck in. But, yeah, I think Warren Gatland maybe has 7 or 8 lads in the back of his mind that are going to be in the starting 15, but the other jerseys are still up for grabs.
Do you really think so, that he'd have that many that he wouldn't be sure on yet with just one game to go?
Well, those 7 or 8 are probably Welsh men, to be honest with you, Marie. But yeah, like, you know, I think Rory Sutherland's done enough. I think Tadhg Furlong's done enough. The hooker position's still up for grabs. One of the second rows, one of the back rows, that's 5. We're not sure. You're not sure. It's scrum half at the minute. 10, we're probably... we're not sure again on 10. Maybe Dan Biggar's in a 10. The centres are all up for grabs. Fullback, is it Liam Williams? Stuart Hogg. Liam Williams has got a bit of an HIA. He's going to be out this weekend. Josh Adams, try-scoring machine. but Rhys Ahmed, Anthony Watson, like, do you know what I mean? So it's really, really tough. It's just all about the way he wants to play. And I just rewind the clock back to the 2019 Rugby World Cup semi-final when Wales took on South Africa and came very, very close to beating them. And, you know, there was just so much kicking in that game. It was back and forth, kick, chase. And I think Warren Gatland will want his wingers, his back three, to just have an unbelievable work rate. I don't think you're going to need an absolute speedster like Lewis Reed-Zammett on a day against the Springboks in their own backyard. So, yeah, that's the way it is at the minute. I see 7 or 8 lads that are kneeled down, and the rest of the space is up for grabs.
Yeah, and that could all change over the weekend as well. Stephen, we will check back in with you next week ahead of that first test and see what your team is looking like then. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to take a quick break.
Marie.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new cooked chicken breast fillets are 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now I am joined in the studio by former footballer Paul Carey, who is watching Sligo Rovers take on FH in European action. Paul, how are they going?
Yeah, really well, Maureen. If they keep at this and keep playing the way they have been, the goal will come, because they've created a number of chances. And on the 20-minute mark, there was a massive chance for Romeo Parks. It was a great diagonal ball from Figuera from right to left. Parks peeled off the shoulder of the centre half. He's taken on his chest and he's just dragged it wide. And that's been their best opportunity to date, but they've created a number of chances and they've had the majority of possession, and you feel if they can just be patient, keep working the ball, keep working the opposition, that there's going to be more there, and they just need somebody to take one of those chances.
Okay, well, it sounds good. We'll be keeping an eye on that for the rest of the show. Now, I'm delighted to say, with thanks to our very kind sponsors at Green Farm, Orla Walsh, dietitian, is with us to have a very timely chat about the Olympics and the importance of nutrition. Orla, how are things?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. I think this is an absolutely fascinating topic, because a lot of our athletes now will have touched down in Tokyo and will be doing their final preparations ahead of, which is really the biggest moment of their life, the thing that they've been dreaming of for such a long time. And they will have every single box ticked. And one of them is going to be nutrition, Orla. Just for an athlete performing at that level, how important is nutrition when you're looking at these tiny marginal gains?
Yeah, nutrition is incredibly important. And when we talk about nutrition and sports, we often focus on the marginal gains, which are important, obviously. But I suppose the nutrition's role in the 4 years previous was very much focused on keeping them well. So helping to prevent injury, helping to prevent illness. Because what makes a good athlete great is how many training hours they have. And so nutrition's been a huge focus for them for that reason. And then I suppose nutrition over there has a couple of areas that, you know, that are important. Would be, well, I suppose, you know, enjoyment and pleasure, and, you know, because there is time between training and time between all of these things. Then nutrition for the performance aspect, but then there's the food safety aspect as well, because you don't want them getting sick. And I guess nutrition as well is helpful if they, you know, get jittery and have stomach issues, shall we say.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to an Olympic Games as well, there's a lot to it, because you're in a different country. The climate is more than likely going to be very different. The food that you eat is going to be different. It's going to be something that is out of your control. I know that you have worked with athletes who've gone to an Olympic Games before. How different is it to go to a tournament like that, and what's on offer for athletes?
Well, the selection is unbelievable. It's great. You know, in Rio, they had nearly everything they could possibly want. So I guess sometimes with athletes, you're focusing on, okay, well, when you're over there, you know, how do we make sure that, you know, your body adjusts to, I suppose, the different climate and the time difference. How do we use nutrition to help with sleep? How do we use nutrition to help with tummy issues? How do we use nutrition to help you even on the flight and beforehand prepare for the different time and place in the world that you're going. But they know they have a great selection. So sometimes your role is, you know, to help them pick what's best for them over there, especially if they suffer from gut issues. But because there's plentiful food, there is issues around that as well, because, you know, if it's a sport that they have to make weight, it can be another challenge, another set of challenges, because they can't go wild.
Of course, yeah, I can imagine it must be difficult to be disciplined, even if you're just a regular athlete, not someone that's trying to make weight. When you have so much choice and it's right there in front of you, I'd say it's difficult.
Yeah, and there's so many, you know, different sports, I suppose, that are, you know, it's not, I suppose we think of Olympics and we might think of track or something like that, but, you know, obviously there's the cycling track, which would be very different to just say the road cycling. So the likes of Shannon McCurley, who's a cycle track athlete, like, she would have to have different foods than the road cyclist. Or, you know, Ollie Dingle would have Dingley would have different stuff than another athlete, maybe one of the golfers or something. So it does vary, but you see, a lot of what you do beforehand is nutritional education. So they know themselves, they become nearly pros at it. You don't want them to become too obsessed with it, because that, you know, has issues as well. But they have the education behind them for, you know, so that when they go over there, they can make the right decisions for them at that time.
I remember when the rugby team were heading to the World Cup, and there was something about their nutritionist in the media, and that person had gone over to the hotel they were going to be staying in, and was giving all the different requirements that the different players had, and making sure that the porridge was made in the right consistency and that. So it really is such an important thing for athletes. Like, it's they like to know what they're going to get and when they're going to get it and how they're going to get it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's a taste from home and a comfort to them as well. And some of them are very young, so they're going away and they're going away for a long time, and perhaps without their mammies who supply their meals. So there's a lot of unknowns, you know, and there's so many unknowns for them, and I think it can be quite nerve-wracking. But, you know, they are experts, they are the, you know, professionals in their area, and I simply can't wait. They will all, I'm sure, have their nutrition planned out to a T, but you have to have an element of flexibility there as well, should something arise, delays or what have you. So you have to prepare for every eventuality.
Orla, do any of the, I guess, more of the high-profile athletes, like some of your 100-metre superstars, do they actually take control of their own cuisine and their own kind of food and preparing their own nutrition, or are they happy with what's available in the village?
It depends how rich they are. You know, if you have people working for you and people doing stuff and you're that important. The one thing that, having worked with a lot of the, you know, some of the athletes in Rio Olympics and the Paralympics, is that, you know, usually the better they are, the nicer they are. I find them so humble and really more like, you know, I'll do it for you. You know, they're absolute gents. I was taken aback because I've worked in lots of different areas of sport, and I have to say, Athletics Ireland athletes were just, they were gem. They were humble. They were just incredibly nice to work with. Although if I were to pick favourites, it would be the Paralympic Olympians, the track cyclists. They were possibly my favourite people to work with, because they were the most professional people I've ever worked with in sport.
Oh wow! And they get the exact same experience then when they go over as well. So they will have that Olympic village and everything that goes with it. Do they get a chance to cut loose? Are they on it all the time when they're over there?
I remember one talk that I went to, and it was infection control while at the Olympics. And I thought it would be, you know, things like nutrition and food safety and stuff, and it was more to do with condoms and STIs. So, no, they do let loose, but I suppose they can't let loose until, you know, they ran the race and or competed. And, you know, they have to stay focus to the end, and it can be hard because you could be bunking with someone who could be snoring or something like that. So again, everything has to be prepared for. So for example, if you're in with a snorer, you might have slept with a fan, you know, or white noise for weeks before, or else actually played snoring on out loud
during the day so that you're actually acclimatized to the person's snore, that it doesn't keep you up. So there's loads of weird and wonderful things going on, and there's so many staff supporting and support staff supporting each athlete, and in a range of different areas, from exercise physiologists to strength and conditioning obviously having a majorly important role, and physiotherapists, and of course the performance nutritionists.
How different is the competition training and nutrition approach to when you are actually in competition?
Well, when you're in competition, most sports, you know, your main fuels are water and carbohydrates. So if you're just, say, about to go cycle a race, you know, it's carbs and water that are going to be king that day. And the other food groups are less important. But that said, you still got athletes that, you know, their hunger has to be controlled on those mornings. You know, you don't want to fill up too much on protein, for example, in the meals leading up to the races. But they do need the protein hits in terms of blood sugar stabilization and energy and all the rest. So you would focus maybe on lean proteins and lower fat and lower fiber foods. So sometimes actually the day, people will be amazed when they see athletes on the day eating, because they're not following the standard healthy eating guidelines, because everything is, you know, low fiber, low fat. It can be quite processed, and there can be a lot of jelly babies and stuff. So people can be taken aback by the quality of the nutrition on the day, but that's the difference between healthy eating and performance nutrition, and has to be tailored to the moment. So, like, all of that will be done and practiced a million times. There'll be nothing new on the day. And even with the sports aids that you would have, for example, they might have the beetroot juice after they have their brush their teeth in the morning, and then 45 minutes beforehand have a very prescriptive dose of caffeine supplements. You know, everything is very precise and tailored and practiced a million times.
Okay, Orla, stay with us for a minute, because I'm just going to cross over to Paul Curry, who's sitting here with me watching the Sligo Rovers FH game, and there has been a goal. Paul?
Yeah, not good news, and it's really disappointing, because it's come against the run of play. Sligo have been well on top, much better side. It was a free kick in the 43rd minute in the wide left area. Ball swung in, failed to clear. Second ball's landed in the box, and FH have put it away. So I spoke about it earlier on in the week, Marie, about Irish sides in Europe. It tends to be how clinical you can be in either box, and they've had more than enough chances to go ahead in this game, and unfortunately now they've gone behind, and massive gap now to fill being two behind.
And I know it is a cliche, but a terrible time to concede a goal as well.
Yeah, woeful. Like, Liam Buckley would be really frustrated, because, like I said, they created so many chances, and you don't mind if a team opens you up with good play. A set piece is basic. You just need to defend your box. You need to clear your lines, and they failed to do so. So really disappointing. It leaves a massive hill now in the second half to try recover that 2-0 deficit.
So, you know, they have been creating chances. We know that they have a lot of their good players back. Not all of them, but they do have players who are capable of scoring goals, like Johnny Kenny. What else do they need to do to try and claw it back? They are at home.
Yeah, probably have one of those chances fall to Johnny Kenny, because both of their gilt edge chances have fallen to Romeo Parks. There was one I mentioned earlier where he dragged it wide. David Cawley's put in a really good ball, and it's a header probably 6 or 7 yards out, and it's come off his shoulder. And it's funny, when you start creating chances, they always seem to fall to the same face, and it just doesn't seem to be Romeo Parks' night tonight. But they've created enough chances in the first half that if they can come out, score early in the second, there's got to be confidence within the first half display that they can bring themselves back into it. But the fact that they've created a lot, not scored, you know, it doesn't bode well.
Right, well, there is a whole other half to come very, very shortly. I'm going to go back to Orla Walsh, our nutritionist, who is with us because of our kind sponsors at Green Farm, and we are talking about Olympic athletes and the importance of nutrition, and also the fact that they are all going to be heading for the Olympic Village very, very shortly, and they will have anything they want there. Every sort of a food that you can imagine is at their fingertips, but they don't always eat it, Orla, because they are so disciplined. Are they just like us, though, really, do you think? Do you think that we can, if we put our minds to it, can follow a diet that an Olympic athlete would be on?
No. No. They,
you know, they're Olympic athletes because they're exceptional. They're superhuman. They nearly have superpowers. And they've all had to overcome so much as well to get to where they are. And it's not an easy road. And, you know, I suppose why you'd be so proud of the Irish Olympians is that, you know, unlike other countries, there isn't the same money pit, and they still achieve so much. But it's desperately exciting. There's so many new people this year and so many new faces and so many young faces. And I'm particularly excited to watch Nadia Power and Marcus Lawler and Sarah Lavin and Phil Healy and sorts. And, you know, I think in the next, I know it's not long now to start, but all of these people will have taken every angle. They won't leave anything on the pitch. So they will have taken everything to make themselves great, and that includes nutrition. And it really is, it's the years that, and all the years that have led up to it, and solid, consistent nutrition that is part of what got them there. But they wouldn't be perfect, because perfection is nearly an eating disorder. So a lot of athletes would have a healthy mindset in terms of food, and they wouldn't just say, you know, they'd enjoy chocolate cake like the rest of us. But no, they are superhuman, and we can't compare ourselves to them.
That's probably a good thing. And you mentioned there just the fact, look, I think we all know that a lot of Olympic athletes, the majority of them are doing it for the love of their sport. They are not going to make a huge amount of money. They are amateurs, unless they're the likes of Usain Bolt or the really big superstars. And there is a perception, Orla, that eating well costs money. Is that the case?
No, and, you know, and I think that's a part of the nutrition education, that you have to consider the fact that they wouldn't be loaded. They wouldn't have a huge amount of money at their disposal to afford, you know, all the gimmicky foods, certainly. But the basics, the standard basics, like, you know, the standard Irish diet, the old school Irish diet, is wonderfully nutritious, and they stick to the basics of, you know, carbs for energy, protein for the muscles, and add a bit of colour to each meal. And, you know, they might do things like carb cycling and stuff like that, but, you know, which means that they get the bulk of the carbohydrates, you know, before and after they train. But they'll be very careful to get the likes of their protein hits 4 or 5 times a day.
And just before we finish up, Orla, look, it is very warm out there. Change in the weather. We're all quite hot. For people who are heading training this evening and will be heading training over the next few days, any tips for staying on the right track and getting that right food when the weather has changed?
Yeah, absolutely. Hydration is key. So I'd encourage people to hydrate. So lots of water, but milk is more hydrating than water, and it's a great recovery liquid. So I would promote that in a pint of milk after they train, but make sure they get the protein hits, 4 or 5 of them throughout the day, just to make sure their muscles are getting the food that they need, and to make sure that they're making their meals as colourful as possible, because then you'll get all the electrolytes and hydration and protein and everything that you need to be a better athlete, regardless if you're going to the Olympics or not.
Good advice. Orla Walsh, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a very quick break now, and then we're going to check in with Greg Allen, who's watching the Open for us.
Dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Now, Sligo Rovers are trailing FH. It is half time and they are 1-0 down, but we'll be hoping for better things from Bows when they take to the pitch a little bit later on. Do we have some team news, Paul?
We do, Marie, and they're unchanged from last week, and that doesn't really surprise me. It's the, I guess, the cohort of players that have seen the turnaround in form over the last number of weeks. So it's Talbot, Lyons, Feely, Kelly, Wilson and Buckley. You can almost say that's their back four, with Buckley marshalling in front, and then they heavily rely on Tavoy, Tierney, Coote, Burt and Kelly to score goals. So they're probably the one team who would have rather the way goals still be in place, because they got one last week. So they're going to have to score tonight, and they've definitely got enough in that final third. They've showed enough last week that they can definitely win tonight and progress into the next round.
Well, we hope so. Now it is time to turn our attention to golf. Greg Allen is watching the Open for us, Greg.
Yeah, Rory McIlroy is still out there, five holes to play, and it's not going well. Even that birdie in the first didn't really inspire him. A beautiful birdie, 102-yard wedge to 3 feet, tapped it in, one under par after one. Compare that to the eight that he took in the first hole of Royal Portrush 2 years ago. But there was those three bogeys in a row from the fifth, and from there on he has just been matching bogeys and pars and birdies with equal measure. So he's two over after 13. That's tied for 91st place. Alongside him, Patrick Reed, who he's playing alongside. Justin Thomas also two over par. There's been some disappointing rounds on a day of good scoring for players you wouldn't expect. Bryson DeChambeau, one over par 71. Patrick Cantlay, the world number seven, at four over par 74. And even John Rahm, the pre-tournament favourite, is over par with a 71. And that, at the moment, is tied for 69th place. So a lot of players between John Rahm and the lead. But the lead is held by Louis Westhuizen, and it's been a beautiful day for Louis Westhuizen, who's been runner-up in the last two major championships. Six under par 64. Leads by one from Jordan Spieth, 65, and Brian Harman's 65. Two Americans sharing second place behind the South African. And in the group on four under par, Mackenzie Hughes of Canada, Dylan Fratelli of South Africa, and Stuart Sink, the 48-year-old American who was the Open champion in 2009. Webb Simpson has moved to four under after 17 holes. And Benjamin Hébert of France also four under par. Justin Rose shot a 67. Brooks Koepka, of course, the most successful player in the majors for the past 4 or 5 years. He's one under par after a 69. Colin Morikawa, the world number four, three under par after a 67. Brant Snedeker had that rare thing. He had a couple of twos back to back, one under par three, one under par four. He shot around a 68. But from the Irish point of view, a 71 for Shane Lowry, a 71 for Darren Clark, a 72 for Patrick Harrington, and Rory McIlroy, two over after 13.
And tomorrow, Greg, are you hopeful for improvements from our Irish?
They better, because the scoring is just too good. At the moment, looking at the leaderboard, it is 46 players under par, and the par here is 70. So there are now, at the moment, 68 players who've shot rounds of 70 or better. And that's 68 players better than any of the Irish. So if you're looking at the real contenders, I think you can look at, obviously, Lowry and McIlroy. And obviously, Patrick Harrington, with the form that he's shown recently. They really need to shoot in the mid-60s to have a chance of getting back into this, because there's going to be more good scoring tomorrow because the weather is to stay for the weekend. A similar wind to the one that they've been practicing in from the northeast, not to be too heavy. And it does look as though somebody among the Irish has to make a big move if we're going to have an interest in this over the weekend. And a round of 65-66 might be required.
Well, hopefully, Greg, as always, thank you so much for joining us. That is all we have time for this evening, Paul Corrie. Thank you for coming into studio. We will be back tomorrow looking ahead to a very busy weekend of GAA action. Tara Stewart is up next.